Looking over at our AGP friends. Okay. Welcome to the April 17th, 2018 regular meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District Board of Trustees. The board met in closed session to discuss the public employee performance evaluation of our superintendent, and then also for anticipated litigation, significant exposure to a potential case. Do we have a Mrs. By the way, Mrs. Roger will join us shortly. She's having a problem with one of her tires on her car, so she needs to get that attended to so she can drive home tonight. Do we have a consensus on the order of business?
Yes.
Okay, good. Let's go on to item 4.03, approval of minutes for 3/27/2018. Do I have a motion for that?
I move approval of the minutes for March 28th.
Okay, we have a motion by Mr. Quesenberry. Do I have a second?
Second.
Seconded by Dr. Eisendrath Rogers. Any discussion on that? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. The motion carries 6-0 with Mrs. Roger absent. Let's move on. The second was Dr. Eisendrath Rogers. Let's move on to item number 4.04, approval of minutes for 4/12/2018.
I'll move approval of the minutes of 4/12/18.
Okay. It's been moved by Mr. Millar and seconded by Mr. Buckman. Any discussion on those? It was a lovely event. But what we're talking about is that was a meeting that we held at Bellevue Santa Fe Charter School to be there for their essentially ribbon cutting and groundbreaking for for the new classrooms that are being made possible by Measure D. It was very fun. Yeah, Jim.
No, I'm fine.
Okay. Yes, Mark. Oh, sure, you can.
Okay, I'll
say. Actually, you can. So we have a motion by Mr. Quesenberry and a second by Mr. Buckman. Yes.
No,
I'm sorry. Motion by Mr. Millar and a second. Oh, boy. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? The motion carries 5 with one absence and one abstention. Let's move on to item number 5.01, the Baywood Makerspace. So, Mrs. Dinelli, Mr. Curran, anybody else?
Yeah, this is actually Mr. Curran's show here, so thank you so much for having us to share tonight, and Mr. Curran will introduce these students who are really excited to share about our makerspace.
Hi, my name is Mr. Curran. I'm blessed with the opportunity of teaching fourth grade at Baywood Elementary School and having these fantastic young ladies in my class.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Naomi, and I'm also in the fourth grade. If you're on your cell phone right now, please continue texting that very important person and tell them to get over here. What we're about to share is very inspiring, important, and empowering.
Hi, my name is Astrid. I am in fourth grade, and Mr. Curran is our teacher. Mr. Curran is the kindest teacher anyone could ask for, a man whose compassion knows no bounds. Generosity should be his middle name. He would do anything for me. In fact, he even wrote this section of my speech.
Hello, my name is Brooklyn. You have probably guessed that I am also in fourth grade. Good job, you are correct. In class, Mr. Curran has been teaching us the importance of research. We have been focusing on the who, what, where, when, and why while reading through nonfiction texts. We thought that it would only be appropriate to take you through a similar educational experience tonight. This evening, the four of us will be speaking on who a makerspace is for, what it actually is, where you could host a makerspace, and why a makerspace could change the climate and culture of your campus. First up is Mr. Curran himself with the who.
Yes,
very humble. So contrary to popular belief, a makerspace is not just for engineers, designers, architects, or people who are techie. A makerspace is for anyone who has a beating heart, a willing attitude, a growth mindset, and a brain that produces neurons. If that wasn't clear enough, I made a list of people that would benefit from a makerspace. Let's go here. Makerspace is a place for you. It's a place for me. It's a place for your dad, your cousin, your neighbor, your mail carrier, your butcher, your soccer coach, your refrigerator repairman.
Mr. Curran, we don't have all night.
All right. We'll just skip down to the end. A makerspace is for everyone, anyone, and most importantly, students.
Thanks for that, Mr. Curran. I have the privilege of teaching you what a makerspace actually is. I promise not to use any long list so as to respect your time. As librarian Diana Medina puts it, a makerspace is a place where students can gather to create, invent, tinker, explore, and discover using a variety of tools and materials. A makerspace can be anything from a repurposed book cart filled with arts and crafts supplies, to a table in a corner set out with Legos, to a full-blown fabrication lab with 3D printers, laser cutters, and hand tools. It is basically a space where you can use your imagination to make things, and we should definitely have them on our campuses. No two schools' makerspaces are exactly alike, nor should they be. Makerspaces are as unique as the school cultures they represent.
Like Naomi mentioned, a makerspace can take many different forms. Tonight, I will be talking to you about where the Baywood Elementary makerspace is located and how it got there. First off, let's look at these two photos. Here is our computer lab a few years ago. It serves a limited amount of functions, and the space is inflexible and fixed into place. You can use computers, and that is about it. Now let's review the next photo. This is a picture of our current makerspace. It is the exact same room as the photo before. However, there are endless possibilities in the space. All of our tables are on wheels so that we can push them aside and open up the room. We have flexible seating options, and this space encourages movement. We currently operate 3 3D printers that bring imagined designs into existence. The pegboard wall is a place where kids can create marble runs as they face challenges and are forced to problem solve. We have a green screen video production, tons of materials, tools, a Lego wall, and so much more. Many items have been crowdsourced and donated by the public. Thank you to everyone who has contributed.
Now that you know who the makerspace is for, what it is, and where Baywood stands today, I would like to bring things to a close and explain why we have a makerspace in the first place. Many leaders at our school realized that our old computer lab was lacking flexibility and versatility. The room served only one purpose and was more of a drive-in movie theater for computers. However, at this drive-in, the cars never left. Therefore, Mrs. Dinelli and other staff members saw a need to make some drastic changes. The computers left, and like Brooklyn listed off, so many new and cool things replaced them. I would now like to read off a list of problems that teachers have been stating over the years. Mr. Curran, Naomi, and Brooklyn are going to help name some solutions to these issues. Problem: my students need more time and space to fail in a safe and welcoming environment. Solution:
get a makerspace.
Problem: my students don't have enough time in the school week to be creative. Solution:
get a makerspace.
Problem: my students these days are spending too much time being consumers of technology and not producers of innovation. Solution:
get a makerspace.
Where was I? Problem: my students must have more opportunities to think critically and collaborate with peers. Solution:
get a makerspace.
Last but not least, and probably the most common amongst teachers, problem: my coffee pot is broken, and I have no idea how to fix it. Maybe I'll just go buy a new one. Also, I have this invention in mind that I really want to put into production, but I have no place to create a model of it and no tools to help me along with the design process. Solution?
Get a makerspace.
Thank you all so very much for listening to what we have to say. Have a great rest of your evening.
Well, don't go away. Well, come on back. Well, first of all, I want to go to the board and see if board members have any questions for you. Mr. Buckman.
So I have a
a TV that's not working. Can I bring it to you, or should I get a makerspace?
Probably get a makerspace.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions from board members? Well, Naomi, Astrid, Brooklyn, and Mr. Curran, we want to thank you very much for sharing the Baywood Makerspace with us. It's really exciting what you guys are doing. And by the way, anybody who hasn't had a chance, with Mrs. Donnelly's permission, of course, to see your classroom should really go see it, because it's really an exciting place for learning and a really flexible spot that is just pretty darn awesome. So thank you very, very much. Okay, next, we've got the Los Osos Middle School Robotics Team. So, all right.
Hello, good evening.
Mr. Robinette.
Yes. Hi, I'm Matt Robinette, teacher here at Los Osos Middle School, and I have the pleasure of also teaching a robotics class. And these fine young gentlemen here did awesome this season. They won regional awards. They went to state championships, and we recently just got back from the national championships in Iowa, where we earned ninth place in the nation.
Wow.
So.
Whoa.
They would like to tell you about their robot and the process that they went through and what they've learned.
So, hi, my name is Sihil Gavandi, and I'm going to be talking to you about the game and what the challenge is this year. The challenge this year was called Vex IQ Ringmaster, and pretty much what it was there was rings on a 4x8 rectangular field, and what you had to do is pick up rings off the ground and off the side of the field and get them color-coordinated, as there's three different colors, so that you can score the maximum amount of points with another member from like another country or somewhere from another part of the state. When we were at nationals, we also got paired with a bunch of teams, and we had to discuss strategies and other stuff like that.
I'm Riley Logan, and I'm also in eighth grade, and I'm going to talk about our robot, this one right here. It's not in the best condition, but it'll work. So the thing on the back right here is a conveyor belt, and what it does is it scoops up rings off the ground and puts it into these little buckets that are on top of the claw. Now, in the match, the claw is at the exact level for the starting positions or the starting posts that Sahil talked about that are already color coordinated, so you can get a ton of points with those, and it just adds rings onto those.
Yeah, so it goes down the slide and then it slides onto whichever color there's from the ring post, and it maximizes the amount of points.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
Hi, I'm Casey. I'm going to be talking about our robot here. We have a double linear slider with a forklift-style claw. It has a device on the side to pick up rings off the ground, and the forklift claw can pick up rings from the starting pegs. It can pick up three of them, and we also can pick up rings off the ground to maximize the score.
Hi, I'm Caden. I'm going to talk about the coding for our robot. And so, anyways, we have preset heights for our linear slider. And so in that case, it's extremely reliable, and we don't have to manually move the slider up to the starting post. And so we can press a button, and that goes to the specific height we need to. And then if I press it again, it'll go to the top, and then there's a back elevator. In that case, it reaches the top of the pole. And we also have a code to where if you press that too many times, it won't go too high or too low. It won't fall off. It'll disable. So in that case, it doesn't go too high or anything that isn't necessary.
So we have the same thing with our robot. We have preset heights, and what we use for that was the gyro sensors. And we have the gyro sensor on the side of our arm. So it shows the reading of how high and like what position the claw is in. Because if your claw goes too high, then it's going to self-destruct and completely break.
I guess not.
Yeah, if you have a gyro sensor, it calibrates it to where you can say, go at a certain height and then stop so that it won't self-destruct.
Yeah, a gyro sensor senses rotation. So without it, I mean, that's how it senses it. It doesn't move up and down like theirs does. The motor right here actually rotates. And the reason that it would self-destruct is because the torque ratio is so strong that it literally just pulls the robot out and completely destroys it.
Wow.
All right, we're going to show you the video of our, like, our sample run from yesterday that we...
That's what I just
said. So anyways, Neil's robot is taking the blue uniform while my robot is picking three red rings off the ground. And so Seal's robot can hold all three. So right now he's just taking blue and green, and I'm taking the red and the bonus tray. So for the bonus tray, you flip two levers down, and that'll spill out 20 rings. So for my robot, had kind of an accident right there. The bonus tray is worth 20 points, and if you push a ring behind the black line that the posts are on, that's worth 1 point.
20 seconds left.
And so anyway, Sahil is, I think he put on like five rings.
Yeah, with like
Five seconds.
At the start,
three, two,
high or too low, and that can cause it to self-destruct or not reach the uniform post.
Wow.
But so we have to calibrate it before we start.
And today we're going to show you how to...
Whoa!
If you write anything on your computer, you need to get Grammarly.
I write... our robots can also have other features, such as instead of just turning like a regular right and left, it can also move without turning. So these are called omni-wheels. Yeah. So the black parts that you can see on the wheel are actually another set of wheels. And so in that case, it can roll smoothly without having to turn or anything. That helped us with a lot more features on the field, like the uniform post. And one
of the difficult parts about this whole competition is there's a size limit. So on the field, there's a specific box that you have to fit in. And if you don't fit in it, they tell you to remake it or, like, do something else to make it fit in the box. So with our robot, we were having a lot of problems with the size limit. So what we decided to do is we put the motor inside and then connected a gear to another gear. We just connected to more gears and then put a chain on it so that whenever the motor in here moves, it forces this to move as well.
One of the main problems we had with our robot was weight distribution. When the claw was all the way up, it was very front heavy because there are two motors to lift the front part of the claw.
Oh, yeah.
And our problem was that it was tilting forward, so it was really, it had problems moving around.
And it also had problems with strafing. So Casey came up with an idea to add three sets of wheels on the back for back weight, and we also filled that with shafts, which put more weight onto it. And so in that case, we put it on two of them on, so it balances evenly between left and right. And we put an extra motor, but there's also a limit for motors. There's a limit of six motors for each robot, so we couldn't just add a bunch of motors that we needed to. And so we added one for the weight on the back, and then we added these two. In that case, now we can still strafe when it's all the way up.
And speaking of weight, the reason that our robot has such an insane torque ratio is because... our goal is to fit like 15 rings onto the claw at one time. So there'd be three here, two here, two here, three here, two here, and three here. And that's a lot of rings, and it's really heavy for this claw to lift. So what it would do is it'd go up and then fall because the motor wasn't strong enough to lift it. And what would happen is it'd end up stripping the gears right here. So what we did was we made a really strong torque ratio so that it can pretty... It lifted like a water bottle and stuff. It's really strong.
And some of the things that we learned throughout our process was engineering and prototyping, because when we were doing these robots, there was a lot of problems that happened with them, and we would have to test and keep making sure that we would fix these problems so that when we were at Nationals or a big competition, you wouldn't have to, if it broke, you would know what to do, and it would be more reliant.
Something that we learned was to strategize with other teams before the runs and to come up with a plan that you could just score the most amount of points with. And depending on what the other robot did, you would want to do the exact opposite. So if you were a robot that picked them up off the ground, you're going to want a robot that picks them up off the side so that you can pick them up off the ground and back up whatever they scored from the uniform posts. And so in that case, we also learned problem solving with our robot. If it broke or something didn't work out, we would have to find the best way to fix it and modify it till it's pretty much at its full potential.
Thank you.
Cool.
Thank you. Questions from the board? Mr. Millar.
I read an article about your competition in the Tribune, and it was really interesting about combining you with other students from other schools in other parts of the country. How was that experience?
There's also other students from other parts of the world. So they VEX, it's the program that we compete in, and they also have a partnership with Canada and China. Mm-hmm. So there was a few teams from China that we actually got paired with. We got paired with one of them.
Yeah, both of us got paired with one of the top teams that was from China, and it was a little bit difficult strategizing with them.
They didn't speak English.
Yeah. So
and you guys didn't speak Chinese.
So we had to figure out a way to like show them like physically on the field what to do so that they would we would score a good amount of points.
So was that overall an enjoyable experience?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
That's great. When I read about it, it was a little confusing.
Some of the teams that we went with didn't do that great because like one of our teams broke something and they were running back to fix it and dropped the robot and the whole thing shattered. So it was just us doing a run by ourselves.
Well, thanks. Congratulations. It's amazing. I don't understand all the terms you're using, but it's fascinating.
Ellen and then Mark.
Thanks for this. This is great. And I saw some of you at the science fair. You had the trash picking up robot, and you know, and it was great seeing you then and seeing how you're progressing and what you're working on. My question is, how many competitors were there? How many teams were there?
There were 69 teams at the national competition.
Well, there were 69 teams in the middle school division, but there were also an elementary division. Okay. I think there's like a total of 81 teams.
Okay, so you came in ninth out of 60. That's awesome. Yeah, great. Yeah, congratulations. This is really wonderful to see. Thank you.
Mr. Buckley.
So overly impressed, but I want to commend you and also the staff. You've overcame a lot of problems, and one of the things for the future that we're being told by staff is problem solving is important. But I have to tell you, when the conveyor belt that broke during the competition, there was a belt that broke, and yeah, so that thanks. So coming up with problem solving that on the fly during the competition, I have to tell you that was really impressive. Really impressive. Thank you.
So, and I'm just curious, were there other schools from California that participated?
Yes, there were some schools from state competitions that we actually competed with.
Yeah.
They made it to nationals, and I think we got paired with one of them from the California state competition.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's great. You guys coming in ninth out of, what did you say, 69?
69 in the middle school division.
69 in the middle school division. I'm just blown away, and I want to thank you for your presentation, Mr. Robinette. I want to thank you for being the sponsor.
That was great. Thank you so much.
Okay. We'll move on to our student board representatives. Zoe, you want to go first? You want to talk about the surf club?
Oh, thank you so much. Hi, I'm Annalise Dempsey. It's okay. I'm going to be next year's ASB president at Morro Bay High School. And to start off, I actually have a statement from a campus club to read Friday Night Live. Friday Night Live successfully put on a simulated DUI crash called Every 15 Minutes this week. We appreciate the fact that the heartbreaking loss of two students was only something temporarily experienced in the CHP-funded crash simulation. As a club, we hope that Every 15 Minutes has made all of our students, staff, and community think twice about driving safely. Our actions have consequences, and we will continue to work so that MBHS can be a place free of senseless, preventable tragedies caused by drugs and alcohol. To continue on, I want to update you all on some upcoming events at the school, such as this Saturday is prom at the Pavilion in Atascadero. The junior class president, Clay Culpepper, and the prom committee have worked tirelessly over the past few months to make putting on the Ritz our best prom yet. For Mental Health Awareness Month in May, ASB will be bringing in therapy dogs as well as doing nice comments for students to pick up on the bulletin boards around the school. This Thursday, April 19th, is spring band concert with the MBHS band and jazz band at the PAC at 7 p.m. with special guest and composer-conductor Jack Stamp. Thank you all so much.
Can I ask you a question? Because my wife just got something that she saw that the surf club did had a really winning competition with Santa Monica too.
Oh yeah, this past weekend our surf club competed in Santa Monica and they did really well.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Ratik.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. And before I get to my report, I just want to comment on the students from Baywood and Los Osos Middle School. I think every single board meeting I've come to, I've been astounded by what these students that are younger than I am are doing, and they sound so much more articulate than I am. And I really wish that all students at Slo High and Morro Bay and everywhere are able to see what students that are younger than us are doing to be inspired by them, because I continue to be inspired by what everyone is doing at the younger levels. So thank you, Mr. Curran. Thank you so much. And I'm kind of bummed they left because I wanted to thank them, but it's fine. But thank you. It really is an inspiration.
May I just make a quick comment?
Yeah, go ahead.
They replay the board meetings. So encourage your friends to tune in to channel 1
for Sundays to watch the board meetings. Yes. Fascinating.
I'm sure they'd love to. But, yeah, so April, in my opinion, April and May should be really relatively easy months for the school year, but it seems like more stuff goes on in these 2 months than the entire year. Last week we had a distracted driving assembly where which took place of the every 15 minutes thing that Morro Bay High School did last week as well. Every 4 years, I believe, two students are simulatedly killed by drunk driving or some type of distracted driving, and apparently 4 years ago it caused mass hysteria at Slo High, so we decided to nix that and replace it with distracted driving. And that they played a video which had students who were affected by other students being killed by distracted driving, and it was very moving. And kind of related to that, I want to go back to my comments at previous board meetings about the crosswalks at the tennis courts, because there have been multiple instances of students almost being hit while crossing the tennis courts because there is no cross guard there and other students are either texting or there are parents trying to pick up their students in a rush. So that problem continues to be a very big issue that has a simple solution by installing a cross guard there. And I implore the board to consider a cross guard. The Slo PD also patrols that area very, very maliciously, other than that, so today we had Tyler Hubley, if Mrs. Holmes, could you pull up that picture that I emailed you, talk about gravity water. Now, last year, the ASB put on a fundraiser for an organization called Gravity Water, which installs clean water facilities inside Nepal, and I can't remember exactly how much we raised, but we donated the money to a school in Nepal in Kathmandu, and they were able to install this clean water facility which captures rainwater and instills it through gravity and filters it to provide clean water for an entire school. Now, this organization has worked with Arroyo Grande High School, Nipomo High School, and Coastal Union, and they continue to expand each year. We are probably going to have another fundraiser this year for another school or continue providing to this school. But I just wanted to say that this organization is incredible. Tyler Hubley, who started it, graduated from AGHS a couple of years ago, and he came in today to talk about it. So we're proud that San Luis Obispo High School was able to sponsor a school in Nepal and provide them with clean water. So Skills USA and FFA will be going to state nationals this weekend, and I will keep all of you updated at the next board meeting on how they do, and I assume they will do amazingly, as they do each year. And then tomorrow is going to be our Tiger Fest, where these organizations, as well as other clubs on campus, are going to be able to showcase their extraordinary students and their abilities to all these eighth graders who are going to be incoming freshmen next year. SLO High has over 35 active clubs, and we want to show our little eighth graders that they can be involved in so many different kinds of clubs, and they will find their niche no matter how weird it may be, because there are students just as weird as them. So that's our goal tomorrow at Tiger Fest, capturing all these eighth graders' interests and making sure they become involved in high school, because that's really what high school is about. I skipped over one thing, I'm sorry. We had a baile de primavera on Saturday, and unfortunately I was unable to attend because I was at Bruin Day. But so the whole point of that was to encapsulate the inclusivity and diversity on our campus. It was mainly Latino music and Spanish music played at that dance, and we tried to get a different population of students who don't usually come to dances. And while I wasn't there, so I wasn't able to see the outcome of it, that was our main goal from that, and we continue to try reaching out to a different group of students and making sure that they feel included on campus as well. So that was planned by Shayla Resendez, who is our academics commissioner, as well as working with our Mecha Club on campus and our English Learners Club on campus. So it was awesome incorporating different clubs and having them plan events. So that was that, and I hope it went well, but I haven't been able to follow up on that. Sustainability Week is next week, as well as our canned food drive, and I apologize for listing off a bunch of stuff, but I find these things really important to our campus. The whole point of Sustainability Week is as good as students at SLO High are, we sometimes and oftentimes do get kind of caught up in the moment and just do whatever we feel is most convenient to us, and that means just leaving our trash wherever we find it most convenient and doing things that aren't necessarily the best for our campus. So the goal of Sustainability Week is working with Environmental Club to create this awareness of how dirty our campus actually is and how we can improve it. If you remember a couple of years ago, there's a series called Seagull Slayer, which one of our, I'm not sure if you guys are aware of it, but it was to increase awareness of all the seagulls on campus, where one of our ASP students, Omid Jassemi, basically just killed seagulls. It was kind of comical, but This is a more practical implementation of awareness, obviously, so that's our goal, and then we're also paralleling that with a canned food drive. So that's what's going on at SLO High. It's a cram-packed week and month, as well as next month, so we're going to keep in full swing. But seniors are basically done with school, let's be completely honest, so, you know, yeah. So thank you all for listening.
Thank you. Dr. Eisenrath Rogers, I think you have a question.
I would just like to call attention to the sweatshirt that Rutik is wearing and congratulate him on becoming a Bruin. Yeah. Well done.
I'm 90% Bruin. It's a hard response.
Well, as always, thank you very much. We really appreciate your being here. Of course, you can stay and participate in the discussions that we have. But we also understand that you may have other obligations, so feel free to stay or go. We are always happy to have you here. And then Dr. Prater, oh, I'm sorry.
Jim. I just wanted to tell the team
that. I think you're.
Never mind. We have Harvard and some UCLA.
And then, Dr. Prater, I know as we draw to a close with you guys, well, you'll be back next year, but one of the things I would like you to do, Dr. Prater, is to just touch base with the student representatives, kind of see how it went this year, and if they have any suggestions for next year and how we could make this work better for them.
Sure.
I like that idea. We'll have an exit interview. I'll contact Zoe and Rutik, and we'll get together and we'll conduct an exit interview with you.
Or Riley. Or who, yeah, just.
Okay. Great.
Yep.
Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you very much. So let's move on to correspondence. We did receive one piece of correspondence from Dr. Brescia from the County Office of Education as reviewing our second interim report. I did want to just highlight one of the things that he said, though, for us to be considering as we move forward. To quote him, the district's multi-year projection shows deficit spending in all 3 years. The district has a robust fund balance to offset deficits, but year-over-year deficit spending indicates that the district is not shrinking expenditures concurrently with projected revenues. The superintendent's Blue Ribbon Committee, December 2017, suggests revenue enhancements and cost-cutting measures that would address the district's structural deficit. Please consider implementing these suggestions as the district's rate of deficit spending is not fiscally sustainable. And Dr. Prater, I know that you're having community meetings to share the Blue Ribbon Committee report. Can you just share that really quickly, please?
Yes, we held our first employee forum yesterday afternoon with another one tomorrow and then another one on Friday in San Luis, Los Osos, and Morro Bay. And then the following three consecutive Mondays, we will open forums to the community. And those community forums will be next Monday in J2, where we hold our San Luis Obispo board meetings. Then here the following Monday. And then I believe May 7th in the library at Morro Bay High School. We will see how those forums go. We have a survey tool that goes with it. We did a communication press release today for those community forums. And if everything goes well, I believe, we're going to have a parent leader meeting this Thursday where we'll do the same. So we'll gather feedback. If we get substantial feedback, we know we've hit the right vein, so to speak. And if we need more, we'll continue to publish additional forums. But we think we'll capture the intent of the message, which is from the Blue Ribbon Committee, which is, you know, let's tap in to see what our community and our staff have to say regarding their recommendations.
Great. Thank you. We'll move on to public comment. And just a reminder before we start, this is a time for people who wish to appear before the board to be heard. Anyone wishing to speak, either as an individual or representative of any group, will be given opportunity at this time. Please, when you're recognized, and I see somebody who I know back there, when you're recognized, please state your name and your group, if any, you're representing. No more than 3 minutes per presentation, and we do enforce that strictly now. If you have materials that you'd like to present, you can distribute them to Mrs. Holmes. We also have a document camera there that you can use, but of course that can't go over the 3 minutes. We do not allow the public to use electronic devices or cameras other than the document camera. If you have questions for us, they'll either be answered by me or referred to by a staff member for the answers later. We won't take any action on public comment on items introduced during public comment. That would be an illegal act on the part of the board. It would violate the Brown Act. And if finally a speaker may offer criticism of school operations and programs that concern them, but in our public session we won't hear personal complaints of school personnel or complaints against an employee of the system. We have other channels provide for board consideration and disposition of complaints involving individuals. So that said, I'm going to recognize Mrs. Settle.
Wow, what a group to follow. I'm impressed. You know, very exciting things are going on in the schools. That's not part of my 3 minutes, but greetings to all of you. Some of you already know, but my name is Kathy Settle. I'm a San Luis Coastal Elementary retiree of 12 years now. Presently, one of my volunteer activities is communications chairperson for the Retired Teachers Association, known as CalRTA. Our mission is to protect and advocate for retired and active educators' pensions and other retirement benefits, as well as to support education in our communities. This last sentence is the primary reason I'm here tonight. This year, CalRTA Division 23 offered four $100 mini grants to teachers in this district. A total of 60 teachers from K through 12 applied for these grants. The CalRTA board randomly chose four recipients from the three different grade levels. And in the past, it had been only three grants. But because the large number of elementary teachers who submitted names, they decided to offer one extra grant. So I'm really happy about that, because I'd like to give all the teachers a lot of money. So anyway, I'm happy to announce the winners. There are four. However, two were unable to come tonight. First is David Curran, who I was really impressed with his. Little did I know, you are very deserving. So anyway, I'd like to present you with $100. Denise Crank of second grade had a prior engagement. She couldn't come. Doug Morrow, who informed me that he probably taught my sons. It's problematically my youngest son, but he made it. So,
we survived.
Yes, we all survived. So I'd like to offer him $100. And Kristen Nussbaum became ill and couldn't come, and I found out from her that her sister was one of the third graders that passed through my classroom. She wasn't my student, but she was one of many who learned art, science, and cursive writing. So we are happy to present these mini grants this evening and thank all those who submitted their names for the opportunity to win. So.
Thank you, Mrs. Settle. Congratulations. And just so that you know, you have two CalRTA members sitting up here at the dais.
I know.
Mr. Quisenberry and I are members. So
yeah, but I see him at the meetings. I don't know. But,
ooh, ooh.
You know, you should never say things
thank
like
you.
That.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
But thank you. And I have to tell you one thing.
You have to finish up, please. I can't let you go over 3 minutes, Kathy. Thank you.
It's
sorry.
Nice to see familiar faces.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wants to speak on an item that's not on the agenda? Okay, seeing no one, I'm going to close public comment. Let's move on to item number 7.01, business and budget update. Mr. Pinkerton.
I hit it. I have a few things to review. So I actually met with the new principal at Bellevue Santa Fe Charter School. So taking over for Mr. Getz, Holly Warwick, and so we just wanted to sit down together. She wanted to go over our MOU, make sure that she understood, you know, in terms of how things went over the course of the year. So we had a great meeting. She, I think, is going to be an excellent person to kind of take over Bellevue and kind of take it take it on into the future. Of course, Mr. Getz, it was beautiful to see him receive his plaque at the groundbreaking on Thursday with the rest of the board, so it was very nice. He's not shaving anymore since he's, you know, retired now and moving on, so his suit still fit, so he was happy about that. I did meet with the Health Advisory Committee, so we have representatives from the different unions, confidential as well as admin, and so we look at, basically every year we look at our current health plans that we offer. And so we go over those plans, we talk about it, we discuss it. This is kind of a fortunate year for us in that it's the first year where the actual increase in cost is relatively small. So we're looking at just over a 1% increase in healthcare costs, where we've been seeing 5 to 10% over the past few years. So that's a welcome sign, both for our budget, both for the employees, as we move forward. So the plans all stayed the same. We didn't make any adjustments. Kristen Newland has a separate committee going on right now, and they are looking at kind of just healthcare in general, you know, from everything from how CISC is offered to tiered rates, to combined, you know, all those kind of questions as we move forward, because it's very, I think, important for all of our employee groups to be educated about healthcare. Very important. I did receive an email from Andy Stinson, who is my compadre at Lucia Mar, and he had asked if we would consider as a board, and I'll be bringing this hopefully forward as long as I get some nods of the heads today, that we would enter into what's called a mutual aid agreement. So what they found out from some of the fires and issues that happen up north, that unless you have this agreement in place, it's often difficult to get reimbursed for helping other districts. So by having this, by establishing it now, then, you know, if an event should happen, whether they help us or we help them, we would be able to be in a position to get federal aid or get paid back for doing those things. So so kudos to Andy for bringing that up. He's going to work with both Santa Maria as well as us on doing that. And so I'll be bringing that to the board at a future meeting for us to hopefully approve and join in. So nothing we have to do per se, but it just kind of, just in case something were to happen, we would have that in line. As Dr. Prater said, we do have our Blue Ribbon Committee meetings that are starting up. We had our first one yesterday. Got some good recommendations from staff in terms of things that we could add to our current presentation. So we'll add those in, and that'll be ready for Wednesday. And we'll, again, I think by this week in getting input from staff, we'll be able to add any information or things that we feel would really be important in terms of, so that when we go out to the communities, and of course the staff can attend those meetings if they can't attend the staff meetings, and just to make sure that all the information is out there and as clear as possible as we move forward. So, but I thought it was a very good, you know, kind of first meeting kickoff to review that information. And again, that'll be the presentation itself and survey will be on our website for people to pull up themselves. A lot of the information, too, we did address a lot of it at our LCAP meetings as we went around to all the school sites. So I do feel like most employees can probably, just by looking at the presentation, answer the survey. But even better for them to come, hopefully, and partake in one of those meetings so that we can, again, it's nice to hear personally from people about what they think, both on the revenue enhancement side as well as the cost containment strategies. So it's so very important on those behalfs. And so that's it.
So your request to do the mutual aid, I'm going to hold that until we do advanced agenda, and then we'll bring it back at advanced agenda. I think that would be the appropriate time to get board assent or not.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Let's move on to item 7.02, Ed Services Update. Mrs. McGrath.
Thank you. Just received some good news that Senate Bill 1090 has passed through our first step. So that has passed through the Energy Committee in the Senate and is now moving on to the Environmental Quality Committee. So great news and a good first step. So we will keep our fingers crossed and also encourage everyone to send letters of support if you're so personally inclined to do so.
Could you just please explain or remind people what SB 1090 is, please?
Absolutely. This is a Senate bill that's sponsored by Senator Monning and supported, co-authored by Assemblyman Jordan Cunningham. And this actually gives the CPUC authorization to move forward with the joint proposal that was created between the coalition of cities, counties, and the fantastic group that really worked hard at negotiating a deal with PG&E. So as the CPUC decided that they did not have authorization to approve that proposal, they said that they needed legislative authorization. This Senate bill would give them that authorization. So it would really help with not our ongoing loss of revenue from the loss of Diablo, but it would help create kind of a longer runway in order for us to make some intentional decisions about making those reductions.
Sure, and just a reminder that the CPUC is the California Public Utilities Commission.
Right? Yes, thank you. Education talk. Next, I wanted to let you know that we have even more great robotics news, and Slow High has found some also fantastic robotic success, and we're going to invite them at the next board meeting. They won a state championship and are moving on to world championships in Kentucky, so you'll get another great presentation from them as well. Wanted to let you know that we have a foundation steering committee. That work is continuing as we continue looking at forming an education foundation, and thank you to Catherine Eyes and Jeff Rogers, who volunteered to serve on that board, and we are looking for community board members for the foundation. We'll have a fairly large board for that, people that are ready and willing to fundraise and really work together to do great things for kids and create a great foundation. We're crossing our fingers that we'll have funding from this Senate bill, but if not, we will still create an impactful foundation no matter what. And finally, I wanted to bring your attention to, you have on your action consent agenda today new modified courses that we reviewed last time, and you asked for a couple of adjustments, and I happily made those adjustments. I actually, sorry I didn't catch them myself, and that's in action consent, but I just wanted to bring to your attention that we did make the adjustments to the courses that said something about private lessons, and of course we would never require a student to do that. So we changed the wording to would require extensive practice outside of class. We did remove a couple of the band courses because we felt like just more work needs to be done with the band teachers on kind of clarifying some of those expectations. So you won't see those two. They're attending a CTE conference in their field and working with Liz Moore on kind of making some of those adjustments. So we'll get back to you on those two, but you'll find the rest of them included today.
Dr. Prater.
Yes, and I just want to bring this update to a close by acknowledging two fine schools in our district. One is Teach Elementary, and the other is Del Mar Elementary. Both have been selected by the California Department of Education for California Distinguished School, and we're quite excited for their success story. And as a note that deserves additional praise, we're the only, Del Mar and Teach, we're the only two elementary schools selected in the county for this honor. So for that, there's a new set of criteria by the State Department of Education for this honor. For Teach, for their progressive programs as well as their student performance levels, and for Del Mar for really demonstrating the closure of achievement gap. So there's a really great story to be had with both of those schools within the same district. And then finally, we were acknowledged as a school district. San Luis Coastal School District was acknowledged as one of 20 school districts across the state of California as a district of excellence. So for demonstrating promising programs that will close the achievement gap and move our district towards equity. So for that, we're excited and proud, and I just wanted to put that forward.
Great. Thank you. And I would just remind people that there are about 1,000 school districts in California. So my weak math tells me that that's what, about 2% of all school districts in California have been chosen for that honor. And I think that's something we should be very, very proud of. Let's move on to item number 8.01, appointment to SELPA Community Measure D update. Golly, I'm just blowing it. How about 7.03, Measure D update?
Yeah, so just really quick, a couple things. We have been focused on budgets now, and so at our next study session, we'll be walking the board through kind of our updated list of our estimates and overall Measure D budget. As I think it's important as we begin to approve these things that the board sees kind of the big picture as well as each of these pieces that kind of tie into that overall budget. So we'll be doing that our next study session. The other thing that, as well as, I don't know if we'll do this one or the following one, but Dr. Prater mentioned taking the board around kind of on a tour of all of our lease sites and unused school sites as well to kind of take a look at those, kind of in terms of looking at the future. We also, kind of just for the board to understand the CTE grant process. So we have put out 9 applications to receive CTE funds for our program. So each of our CTE programs, you write a grant, you talk about the facilities, equipment, all the things you'd like to do with those. And so we put the 9 out. We received passing scores on 7 of the 9. So you actually, it's a rubric score, a certain amount. So what it looks like to date, and again, it's still going through the process, unfortunately, the governor has only sold so many bonds. So he's only put for so much money to go to these programs. Again, you can see the need. Lots and lots of districts, lots and lots of school districts are trying to have beautiful robotics programs, right, and engineering and doing these things. And so there's definitely a need for school districts across the state to do this. So that said, we had two of our 7 that scored well, it looked like will be funded. So it's a positive thing and great, and we'll take any funds that are going to help us in terms of moving forward. Our goal is that we're going to use Measure D dollars to do these CTE facilities anyways. But these are dollars that are going to help us expand the bond even more, right? So we are focused on the 2 comprehensive high schools to get these programs done. These are just needed dollars because the cost of everything is so expensive as we move forward. So the 2 looks like hopefully will be funded. We will go back to the drawing board with those other 5 that were not funded, as well as the 2 that didn't. And Liz Moore is going to help us with a couple of more that we didn't put forward. And so we'll be looking at all of those and trying to fix them up, make them better in terms of the application so that we do score higher in the future. And then we can put those back in. The next date or deadline is October 31st for the next funding round. But a lot of that is going to be predicated on whether or not Governor Brown sells bonds and puts forward that. So it'll be very interesting over the course of the next few months how that progresses and how it goes. You know, there's been kind of an adversarial role with the governor in terms of he wasn't really happy about more bonds in California and kind of long-term debt, and so he's kind of, you know, edged himself against it. He wants his railway and his train. So it's just an interesting dynamic that we'll see. But there's a lot of pressure between CASH, which is kind of the Coalition for Adequate School Housing, as well as a lot of school districts that are trying to pressure the governor to move forward because there is such a need across the state for adequate facilities.
Great. Thank you. Any questions from board members? Okay, now let's move on to item 8.01, appointment to the SELPA Community Advisory Committee. And I believe that would be Mrs. Frost.
Hi, my name is Diane Frost, and I'm the Director of Student Support Services, and this is Jenny Bash. I want you to know that she is going to be our new representative to the CAC, which is the Community Advisory Committee. This is a committee that is formed through our SLO SELPA, and I think you also know that our SELPA is kind of a consortium of districts that comes together to work with and educate special education students, so our special education local plan area. We are allowed 2 members from our district. We've got Erin Brisky, who's a program specialist, and Jenny is going to take on a 2-year term. And I'll let you say a little bit about yourself and, I guess, your experience. You've gone to a couple of CAC meetings so far.
Yes, my name is Jenny Bash. My daughter, Skye, is at CL Smith. She's in a special day class. My son, Rowan, goes to Pacheco with the wonderful Mr. Mayfield. My husband teaches special ed at SLO High. I've got a master's in education and a master's in psychology. I feel like I've worked at almost every school in our district as a marriage family therapist. I'm currently at SLO High as a marriage family therapist. I've run a support group for parents who have kids with special needs, so I feel like I'm pretty well qualified to be the parent representative. I've gone to a few meetings. Mm-hmm. Now that I'm going to be official tonight, I can actually start my term. But I've been going, I think I've gone to about 5 meetings, just to check it out as a guest, just to make sure it was the right fit. And I think I can do some good things, and I think my experience, as well as my experience with my daughter, will really benefit the district. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I really think we're very lucky to have Jenny take on this responsibility for us.
Great. Thank you very much. This is an action item. So I'm going to go to the public to see if anybody from the public would like to comment. And seeing no one, I'll bring it back to the board. Would someone like to make a motion, please?
I'll make a motion for
Okay. It's been moved by Mr. Buckman and seconded by Mr. Millar. Is there any further discussion from the board? Seeing none, I'll bring it back for a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Congratulations, and thank you very much for offering to serve. So let's move on to item 8.02. This is board priority number one, our LCAP recommendations and suggestions for the LCAP consideration from our Common Ground Advisory Task Force, our Student Senate, and parent staff feedback. Dr. Prater.
Yeah, so tonight what you'll be hearing is really meant for board discussion. And it's not meant for action because these recommendations are just that. They're recommendations that go to our LCAP advisory group for consideration. And ultimately, when we do our readings for the LCAP, when you review the first and second readings, this is where you'll see evidence of these recommendations or suggestions embedded in the LCAP document itself.
Dr. Prater, just for anybody that might not know, can you just quickly summarize what the LCAP document is and what that stands for and what it means for us?
You bet. The Local Control Accountability Plan was enacted as a function of state law several years ago when the governor and the state transitioned into a new funding formula. And the new funding formula was tied to the accountability of that funding formula, the LCFF, the Local Control Funding Formula, was tied to an accountability document, and that's called the Local Control Accountability Plan. And that Local Control Accountability Plan mandated that school districts that receive monies from the state or the federal government actually have an outreach requirement to engage their community stakeholders. This document is tied to eight state requirements. Those eight state requirements are embedded in the LCAP. So we as a district are required to engage our community stakeholders as defined in the document. And I believe each year that we've been doing this, we've become more, I think, adept at becoming skilled at reaching out to our key stakeholder groups. And we still have work to do. But I want you to know I'm feeling more and more confident that our message is getting out there, that we want feedback. We want interested participants to say this is what we think our students in our schools will benefit from. Tonight, we have three pieces of information from three separate groups that reflect that outreach. The first group that I would like to talk to you about is the Superintendent Student Senate. The second group that I will talk to you about is something that we started just last year called the Common Ground Advisory Task Force. I will explain what that is when I get to it. And the third component is the staff and community outreach, which is a function of our parent and employee communities that we have reached out and discussed and gotten their feedback on. So you'll hear three components tonight. And then, again, your feedback, your discussion is welcomed. And the intent is prior to my team sharing the first reading of the LCAP, the intent is that you hear this feedback and know that when you see those goals in the LCAP, you're seeing those goals will reflect that feedback. Or should reflect that feedback. And so we believe they will. And so tonight, what I'd like to start with is the Superintendent Student Senate. Now, some of you may remember this started as an idea. Like, part of this outreach should include our students, our student voice. And I stumbled along this idea of a Superintendent Student Senate. And the way it started was really just as an idea. And we gathered students together from middle and high school. And then as we got better at it, we realized that the feedback was so powerful, but it wasn't aligned to a common data set. So this last year, the Student Senate, which, by the way, is made up of a cross-section of students representing all the major subgroup populations in our schools from middle to high. And those students were identified by the site principals for that representation. And so I've been the beneficiary of being able to work with these students for the last 2 years. What we did dramatically different this last year is that we acquired the services of an organization called Youth Truth. And Youth Truth is a nationally recognized company funded by the Gates Foundation that has developed this survey tool that is given to students that has been normed across the nation. As many as 35, maybe even 43 states participate in this survey. Now, this survey is really focused on student engagement levels, the way they view themselves among their peers, the way they view the adults among their with the peer group, their levels of engagement in terms of academic rigor, expectation, and safety. So those are the primary things they look at. Our student senators are absolutely amazing. I am so proud of their feedback. What we did this year is we had them work with their site administrators on implementing this survey. They did this in October. We received the feedback with 84% participation rate. Next year, we're going to shoot for over 90% for middle and high school. So we had well over 2,500 participants in this survey. And what we did was we gathered the survey data. We had our student groups from the sites work on analyzing their peers' responses. We asked them, what are the top two or three things that you see coming from your peers that you think need to be addressed that are both positive, but we need to work on that? And that was their task over the last several months. And what we did during our last meeting, prior to gathering this info that I'll share with you up here on the wall, is that I invited teacher leaders to come and sit with them during the last student senator meeting, and it was really amazing. The teacher leaders sat with the students and engaged with them around what they saw in the student data. And from that came these top three or four things that each of those schools determined as being really important to be addressed. And so these bullets that you see up on the screen reflect months of work and data that came from the survey. I reduced it to themes so that we don't go through it. We won't consume too much time here. The middle school themes in San Luis Coastal appear to be that we need to engage students in deep thinking through real-world problem solving. We need to build and develop student-teacher relationships and rapport. That level of engagement is important to them. And we need to develop and increase levels of acceptance among student groups, across student groups. This idea of inclusivity and understanding of differences emanates from the middle level. The high school themes appear to be somewhat similar, but age differently. The ages are different. That they believe that incorporating college and career readiness into everyday classes, integrating those conversations and making them real and relevant, is critical to our high school students at both high schools. That developing and fostering greater levels of inclusivity is a critical feature of the feedback. That providing greater access to academic support for our students at the high school level, especially outside of the classroom, is important. And also to ensure that assignments that are given to students are both meaningful and relevant. That conversation occurred time and again, that busy work to busy lives really creates a lot of added stress. So it's one. Many of the students said, we get this. We demonstrate that we know the material and the content, and then we're given 2 hours of homework on top of it. We already showed that we know this. Why do we need to do more? Is the feedback we got. So this feedback has been shared with the teacher leader group, the principals. That will go back to the sites to be reflected in their own site planning. It will also be reflected in our LCAP document, is my guess. Now I'd like to go, if I could, to the Common Ground Advisory Task Force. So those of you that may not know in the public, we developed this Common Ground group based on the realization that our community doesn't necessarily understand all that we've been doing in our district, yet that's part of our responsibility to communicate the things that we're trying to do, maybe not doing well enough, but finding a forum to come to a common ground understanding and a baseline understanding across very diverse parent and community groups in our community that impact schools. So we formed a group that represents all walks of life, from the very liberal civil rights activist portion of our community to conservative religious groups that have come together. And it was rough in the beginning. I admit it was a bit tough, but we've now had 5 meetings this year, and I am blown away by the engagement and, I would argue, the hospitality and friendships that I see emerging from these groups, from the most unlikely people. And so it really speaks volumes to the importance of us waiting to judge until we really know someone. And then when you do that, you're surprised. And in my experience, most people are quite amazing once you give them a chance and understand them. And that's what I'm learning here. So what did we discover when we went through this multi-meeting process of trying to understand First Amendment and free expression in our schools? What came out of it as we began to engage each other around school policy and the events that are occurring in our schools? What came out of it was 2 very profound suggestions to me, which I will then share with you and the LCAP advisory team. And that is, the first part is that they recommend that we develop professional development opportunities for staff and opportunities for parents in the community to participate in this, on understanding diversity and the importance of inclusivity in our schools. In my circles, what I'm hearing, meaning the superintendent and educational circles, the word that what I hear coming out loud and clear is this idea of creating equity in schools. And what I believe this group was really promoting was a similar idea around understanding differences and ensuring that all kids get a fair chance at learning and belonging in our schools. And then the second piece has to do, it's more of the verb, and that is the engagement of one another in civil discourse around differences, around what we fail to understand in others' viewpoints because we shut them down or we don't listen. And so what they're saying is, let's develop our people to become better at listening and engaging one another and honoring and respecting differences in each other and in the groups that we see in our schools. So if you take that common ground suggestion and recommendation around developing capacity in ourselves to be more inclusive and learning how to engage one another through civil discourse, and then you wrap that around the student's voice and the things that they would like to see, I think you can see a common theme running through them. And that's why I'm here tonight to share that with you, because I think we have a opportunity as a school district to do some deep, incredibly powerful work with our students, our parents, and our broader community. this point, I'd like to share, Mrs. McGrath will share the work of the feedback from our staff and community.
Thanks. So we formulated a survey that Mr. Pinkerton and I went around to all staff, and we would give a presentation about funding and LCAP, and at the end of that, we would let them know that a survey was available and that we were very interested in their input. That survey was also sent to parents. We formulated our first time this year an LCAP advisory committee, and this was kind of our first stab at it, of creating a group. We have a great group of participants that are representative of all of the schools, and they have given very valuable impact on how to get the best kind of questions in order to get the type of responses that we're looking for from our staff and from parents. We do want to do a better job next year of being more intentional about those groups, especially our LCAP groups being represented within the members of that advisory committee. Mrs. Shield suggested maybe a DLAC and DTAC rep also serving on the LCAP advisory group, so I think that might be a good suggestion for us to consider for next year. We created this survey and really had kind of an intro to what is the LCAP. Last year we had a lot of great suggestions, but not necessarily things that were related to LCAP, so we were trying to ask the advisory committee, how do we really get the best response that's going to inform our LCAP? So they came up with questions that were pretty focused on each focus area. So you can see here that we had about 526 respondents, about 152 from staff, and 374 from parents. I'll kind of go over some of the conclusions and the patterns that we found. The LCAP Advisory Committee actually looked at every single response. We divided up in groups and people tackled that and looked for patterns of what did staff say and what did parents say. You'll see that here. You see how question 4 focused on our focus area 1 and the first response there being from parents. So you'll see the pattern of what were parents looking for. They were really looking for hands-on project-based learning, kind of learn by doing experiences, as well as visual and performing arts, interventions and individualized instruction, as well as enrichment and some outdoor learning opportunities. You'll see the next one there where staff said, what's your suggestion, right, for improving our academic program? So you'll find some of the same commonalities and a little bit of difference. So you'll see that they were suggesting either maintain or decrease class sizes. We need, prep and collaboration time in order to be most prepared for our students, to emphasize career technical education, to look for more supplemental kind of strategies. We've had to make a lot of curriculum shifts, right, and they said be careful about implementing any more of that, but we really could always use more strategies and interventions. You'll see on the next one that we have more focused on focus area 2 and said, what do you value in that area? It was refreshing to see we really value a skilled, caring staff, which was neat to see kind of a balance there of skills with care. Therefore, the suggestion was leverage your LCAP to continue to train teachers to be highly skilled and caring adults. Counselors, along as special education, after-school programs, and interventions were mentioned. I will continue down to the next one. You can see focus area 3, kind of culture of care. I won't read this entire thing to you, but question 6 there really focused on what did you see within culture of care that's making a difference in the social emotional wellness for students. You can see that access to counselors, kind of continue with counseling and more check-ins, professional development for counselors. They really appreciated the work they're doing. It was a lot of interesting comments about what's happening at recess. So there was a lot of supervision comments at recess, or really teaching students how do we get along and during kind of a less structured time. So there was some interesting comments there about when students are in these unstructured environments, how can we teach them to care for one another. Some peer mentoring and relationships and really looking at some social emotional learning and curriculum around that. So great suggestions there. I'll jump you down to the last one, we had within Focus Area 4. What's the best way to use technology to meet your students' needs? So there we also had some great input, and there was really a message about balance. As we're trying to ensure that students are prepared for the college and career and what's ahead of them when they leave, us also kind of keep a balance with paper, with hands-on experiences, that kind of thing, using technology responsibly and emphasizing digital citizenship, which you'll hear a little more about from Jen here in a minute. So there was a lot of great input, pretty hard to gather 500 and something comments and 5 patterns, but the LCAP advisory group really did a great job at looking at what are the major patterns that we saw and what can we do about that. So now our work is to look at that input and how can we reflect that within the LCAP, and at the next meeting you'll see kind of an overview of what we've done to take that input and to work it into different sections of the LCAP based on that input.
So is there anybody from the public that would like to comment on this presentation? Okay, board member comments. Mrs. Sheffer.
So I have a question about when you say you're going to continue to gather the input and think about how to use it within our programs and teaching day and all of that. Will you be setting out goals by kind of what you're hoping to accomplish in the 2018-2019 school year, or short-term, long-term? I mean, presenting it in a way that we can will be measurable, will be, you know, what will, do you have any idea what that will look like?
Yeah, I think one thing that's important to remember, and this is a message that we gave within the survey and also within our presentations, that we have to keep in mind that this is year one of a 3-year plan. Right, so we have our focus areas, we have our measurable goals, we look at what did we accomplish, what do we need to work on further, and the LCAP and the LEA plan addendum are posted on our website, so that's very accessible and people can see what those focus areas are and down to how the penny is spent in each of those areas. So this is the year to look at how can we massage that and slightly move that in order to ensure that we're responding to our feedback and still meeting the goals. But important to keep in mind, there wouldn't be massive sweeping changes to it since it is year one of a 3-year plan.
Thank you.
Mr. Buckman.
I may just have to speak really loudly, which is difficult for me. I am just really excited that the LCAP committee is up and running, and I know it gives you an opportunity, or what I'm hearing is it gives you an opportunity to just involve it. Cross-section of the community. So that's really exciting. I'm most excited about the Student Senate, and I've been able to go a few times, and it's been really great. But I'm especially excited about it because if you're in marketing, and I do some, if you're in marketing, one of the things they always teach when I work with school districts, it's like you've got to talk to the customer. So talking to the students is going to be powerful, and I think Dr. Prater is making that happen at everyone that I've gone to. So I'm just going to ask the process. The students will be, their comments will be, carry as much weight and be included in the in trying to find the similarities. We'll be able to sort of see their comments in there.
Yes, that's our challenge, is how do we kind of look at the comments from all these different areas and find where it fits in. My personal opinion is the interesting thing about the student comments is some of them are totally appropriate for the LCAP and would impact our district as a whole, and some are site-specific, so that they might show up and you might see some of those within the school's SPSA because it's specific just to needs at that school site. So that's kind of the art right now, is figuring out which of those things impact us as a district and which of those things are maybe better suited for the individual school.
Well, Ms. Quisenberry.
Good. It works. Question 6B was directed, or at least the responses were from the parents, and I thought it was interesting that they listed down their volunteer opportunities. And I'm under the impression that we do have a fair number of parent volunteers at all of our sites, in particular at the elementary sites. how do we deal with the fingerprinting and the background check? Is that at our expense? Is it at the parents' expense? Could you kind of clarify that for me, please?
Sure. I'm not sure if I know that what that one exactly was responding to, but what I believe it was is that when parents volunteer, it's a great way for us to inform and to keep them involved and for them to understand how to be connected to the school. As far as the fingerprinting part on that side, in order to volunteer, Megan's Law has to be passed. Fingerprinting would have to be completed if the adult is alone with a student. So that is typically paid for by the parent.
So adults could volunteer if, let's say, to help supervise a playground and not necessarily, if they're not going to be one-to-one contact with a student, would they also have to meet that fingerprint requirement or...
Megan's Law, if you're within that group. So, for example, if a parent wants to come and help out within the classroom and read with a small group while the teacher is working with others and they're within that classroom while there's a certificated teacher also in that classroom, then fingerprinting's not required.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions from board members? Well, thank you very much, Mrs. McGrath and Dr. Prater. I think we look forward to seeing how this all gets folded into the LCAP, and just a reminder to people that we expect that process really to begin in earnest next month. Thank you. Let's move on to item number 8.03, Bright Bites Survey, and that would be our big basketball fan, Mrs. O'Hagan.
Hello. Do you have one? Perfect.
The reason I say that is every time I go to a Cal Poly basketball game.
Yes, he sees me there. Okay, so I am Ms. Jennifer O'Hagan, basketball fan and TOSA for San Luis Coastal. I'm here to present our second round survey results from our Bright Bites survey. And Bright Bites, just to remind us all here, it's an educational research firm that we've partnered with in order to learn more about our students' school and home technology use and the impact it has on their learning. So tonight I'll be sharing the highlights from our 2018 Tech and Learning Survey. Okay. Let's see. Oh, there we go. It's backwards. Okay. All right, so let's look at the survey process just to get our heads wrapped around this. Last year, it's kind of hard to see, that was winter 2017, we collected from teachers, students, and parents, and those are our numbers, 357 teachers, 3,700 students, and over 1,600 parents were surveyed. And so this year, we really saw an increase. We had almost 100% of our teachers participate, 418, 5,150 students. We only survey grades 3 through 12, so that's close to 100% of our elementary students and almost 80% of our high school students. And then over 2,000 parents were also surveyed this time, so that's a significant increase. And again, all of our schools met their statistically significant thresholds. So I just want to kind of prep you with that information. Let's look at what the data is going to tell us. So it's looking at a case framework, and again, that's classroom instruction. Okay, classroom instruction, access to technology at school and at home, tech skills of both students and teachers, and then the environment. So that would include like IT support, professional development, beliefs about technology, and the policies and procedures we already have in place. Okay, so with all that information, we have set some goals that are in our LCAP you just heard about. And these goals are around digital citizenship in the classroom, the four C's, using technology to foster the four C's, which is communication, collaboration, creativity, and critical thinking. And I think we saw some of that in our robotics presentations earlier tonight. And then again, home access, the student access to technology at home. So this is just an overall score that we received, and it kind of it encapsulates all of the data into one score. And at the top, you see that we have scored 1067, and that's proficient. And I apologize, the color isn't very good on this projector. I think we need a new projector. But if you can try to look at the case score legend below, beginning is gray, emerging is pink. Orange or yellow is proficient, and then advanced is green, and exemplary is blue. So I'm going to have to kind of define that for you. It's hard to see. But we have scored in the proficient range, and so we're trending up. If you can look at the trend graph there, it's just we've gone up a little bit overall, and then it's divided into those four domains. And again, we're scoring advanced in access and skills, and in our environment area overall, we're proficient. And then classroom is emerging, so we have some things to work on in the classroom area. So the next few slides will be diving deeper into the platform, where I'll be showing you elements of these domains with specific data points that relate to our goals of digital citizenship, the four C's, and home access. All right. So goal number one, we want to increase learning of student digital citizenship, and that includes cyberbullying prevention, online safety, establishing an online presence, the legal use of content, and then overall responsible behavior when using technology. So this is a graphic of our digital of all of our skills, but I'm going to focus on digital citizenship skills tonight. Each box shows an overall score of that particular skill as surveyed by our students. And one thing I just wanted to note, if you look at the color coding, again, it's really difficult to see, but multimedia skills, students are advanced 67%. That's the top right corner there. So they're coming in advanced with those multimedia skills, yet they're still emerging on their foundational skills, basic computing skills like sending emails and creating spreadsheets. And I think that's sometimes the opposite of adults. But for these purposes tonight, I want us to look at the digital citizenship skills. And that's still in the beginning area. Although we're still in the gray area, we did move up a few percentage points. So we were at 10% last year in that area, and we have moved up to 13%. And what that means, that 13% means, is it's looking at the frequency of how often they're being exposed to digital citizenship lessons or activities. And so they consider frequency more of on a monthly basis. So we're looking at a frequency rate and striving for these skills to be integrated throughout the year rather than maybe a one-time shot in the arm. And I'll talk more about that in a little bit. Okay. So diving in deeper, this is a more granular level that we can see, where we can see a specific data set and how it compares from last year to this year. Okay. So if you look at the top statement, it says students are taught how to respond to online bullying. Okay. So we are measuring the frequency of this concept being taught. From weekly, if you look from the left to the right, weekly, monthly, every few months, or never, or they're never being taught. So the striped bars are the responses from last year, and the solid bars are the responses from this year. Okay, starting at the right, I'm going to point you over to the pink area. That's pink on the right side there. You can see that last year, 37% of students were never taught or exposed to digital citizenship or activities around digital citizenship. But this year, we have improved because the never number is now decreasing to 33%. So that looking at it that way is showing some growth. Moving from right to left on this graph, we do see that the frequency of students being taught to respond to online bullying has increased, and this is the trend that we're looking for. So we're seeing small gains, and the overall goal is to lower the pink while increasing the greens and the blues on the left. Okay. Okay. So goal two, increase the use of the four C's, communication, collaboration, creativity, and critical thinking. Okay, I'm going to show you another graphic that looks similar, to what we saw earlier. Again, this is a snapshot of data that's been compiled around the four C's. And it's compiled, students and teachers are asked similar questions, and then the data is compiled into an overall score. So again, looking at that legend at the bottom, and then looking at each number and its corresponding color above, tells us where we landed in these different areas related to the four C's. So one thing to point out, one of the goals that I didn't mention earlier or highlight earlier was to increase the use of online assessments in order to provide more immediate feedback for both our students and teachers. And we are up from 37% to 43% of teachers, if you look over there on the right, using an online assessment tool on a regular basis. So this moved us from the pink or emerging to the yellow or proficient in this particular area. And I wanted to point that out because we have done a lot of PD around online assessments and provided a lot of support. And I think there's a big correlation between that and the upward movement in this focus area. And looking at the bottom left of your screen, 74% of teachers are spending less than 3 hours per year teaching digital citizenship. So this is just another data point around digital citizenship that's on this screen that I wanted to point out. And I like having it broken down into to different points like this because it helps us plan for our professional development and target more specific areas. Okay, so again, I'll show you a granular, more of a granular level of a look of data at one of the data points related to the four C's. So this is asked saying teachers ask students to collaborate online with classmates. And again, we see the two bars, solid is this year and stripes are last year. And the same trend is happening where we are seeing the nevers decrease while the frequency of collaboration is increasing. Okay. And then goal three, student access to devices and Wi-Fi at home. Okay. Now here we see district level data on home access for our teachers and students. Teacher data is on the left-hand side of the slide, and student data is on the right. So we can see that all of our teachers surveyed have access to the internet at home, and 97% have a device at home, and I think we knew that. And looking over at the students, we see that overall 95% of our students have access to the internet at home, while 91% have access to a device. Okay. And of that 91%, 54% of the students share that device. Okay. Last year, we discussed needing some clarification on whether or not students would be able to complete assignments using the device that they had at home. And there was some concern that although they may have had access to a device, it wasn't clear whether or not they were able to use it to complete homework. So we asked a custom question specific to homework and technology this time around. Okay, and this was asked to parents. We asked parents to respond to this question. Is your child able to complete homework if online access is required? Overwhelmingly, the answer is yes. And the overall percentage only slightly varies by site, because I did look at it by site, but there are no huge deviations. Keep in mind that this was asked to parents in November, as we were trying to capture parent responses during parent-teacher conferences. And since that time, we have implemented the student access program through T-Mobile, and we expect this number to change for next year. So the final two slides will talk about our conclusions and next steps. Okay. So we saw some changes in our data and can contribute it to the following. With all the data that we received last year, we developed clear goals and shared them. We substantially increased the number of respondents, as you saw in the earlier slide. We purposefully collected from parents during parent-teacher conferences and had devices set up outside of classrooms while parents waited, as well as in the offices. We also waited to collect from students and teachers until February to allow for growth and change over time. We sent home monthly tips on digital citizenship that align with our current digital citizenship program. And we sent those home in parent newsletters each month. We also targeted RPD to include the use of digital citizenship, digital assessments, more support using our data and assessment program, which is Illuminate, and provided PD on collaborative tools as well as digital citizenship. And then we also implemented the T-Mobile program to support home access. So the conclusions here, our takeaways from the second round of data. We have some focus areas. We definitely need to expand the use of the four C's across classrooms and content areas. We need to increase the frequency of teaching digital citizenship skills. It's been primarily taught with our library techs and our high school health teachers. And we want to ensure that students, like I said earlier, have exposure on a more regular basis. And when I reviewed this data recently with the EdTech lead teachers, we found that most students are being presented with digital citizenship lessons and activities in their classrooms with their teachers. But many times it's done in the context of a unit of study or perhaps during the beginning of the school year. So when the students are surveyed in the middle of the school year, they may not recall those activities. And then we also want to continue to monitor and close the gap of home access. So some of the actions we're taking, like I mentioned earlier, we're doing a spring data dive with principals and ed tech leads. I call it a data dive. I've already met with the leads, like I shared, and just this morning I reviewed the data with elementary principals, and we'll do it again with secondary principals. We reviewed our goals both at the district level, and then they looked at it at their site level. And they can further run the data by grade level to target areas of growth and specific needs. Okay. We are using the data to determine professional development topics for our summer techie boot camp, which I'm happy to say is coming soon, our August PD days, as well as guiding our TCTs and staff meetings. We're also establishing a digital citizenship committee next year with some of the EdTech leads in order to continue the work needed to expand across subject areas and build consistency throughout the district. We're continuing our monthly digital citizenship family tips and outreach for next year. And then the T-Mobile program is a two-year program, and it will also continue into next year. So if you have any questions now, I can answer them or... comments?
Mr. Millar, then Mr. Quisenberry, then Mr. Buckman.
Okay.
Jennifer,
yes.
Did when you looked at the 5% of students who didn't have the ability to complete homework, and you looked at it by sight, I understand, were you able to reach any correlation between SED, EL, subgroups?
I haven't looked at it like that yet. What I did notice, the most of the sites were over 90%, so I haven't looked at it quite that closely. Because it's an anonymous survey, it's hard to tell who's. But I did have a discussion with a principal this morning, and they just received their devices and their MiFis, and they're in the process of getting them out, and we're identifying those students right now and those families and making sure that they do have access. So I'm hoping that already that number has changed.
Great. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So that relates to my question, is the T-Mobile program, is that you're talking about devices and MiFi and so forth, and then you're relying on the site administrators, maybe counselors also, to identify families or the students that may need those?
We are, and I spoke with Jeremy Kellish, our new IT director, and he said that they are actually adding a question to InfoSnap, so that we're trying to gather that information when parents are registering their kids so we can get ahead of it and make sure we're not just relying on perhaps this data but other data sources as well to ensure that we're identifying the correct students and numbers.
And would classroom teachers also have some input maybe?
Absolutely. Yes.
Thank you.
Hi.
I'm just so appreciative of all the gains that you've made.
Oh, good. Me too.
But I'm also concerned that we still have such a... So I tend to look at the numbers in the reverse. So you had 85% with, but it still means 15% without. And so I'm looking at the withouts.
Okay.
So in several of the slides, you've got the 90% with, and then there's 10% that still don't. So that's where my questions are coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
So, and I've got several questions, so I'll only ask one, Chris, and then give it back to somebody else. Does that work?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. So one of my first questions is, if we've got just less than half the parents, and I understand that it's statistically significant, but still it's just about less than half the number of parents, I have trouble with the conclusion then that we can say things like all the students or all the homes, because we only have data on about half.
Well, are you talking about the question, the 95 and 5, or are you talking about the other data?
So so several times during your presentation, which is great, you referred to it, so all the students or all the parents or all the homes. And in reality, all we know about is about 2,300 homes. Do you see? Can we extrapolate to
all? The question for that we asked, that extra question, was only for parents.
Right.
The rest of the data in there that's related to who has home access and who doesn't, that's a combination of what students say and of what parents say.
Great.
So we're getting a little bit more from that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay. Great. I just couldn't see that, so that's great.
That's fine.
And then there was something, it seemed like it was new this year, and that's the lack of equipment at home. And it seemed like it was about 5% of the students didn't have equipment.
No, the numbers didn't change, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. They changed by 1%.
Okay.
So we went up. We went from 90% to 91% on that slide that has the blue kids with the teachers on one side.
Right.
And the yes.
Right.
So that went up 1%. I just didn't put it up there.
Well, that's great. So, maybe this is for someone here, but sometimes we have a really good replacement program, so we rotate out the old equipment. Is my understanding that some of that's made available to families?
Yes, so we have a system that when it depends on what type of device, and we have to clear devices and make sure that they're empty, and then we do make those available for families to take home. We're looking at a pattern of that for Chromebooks. There's less to clean off Chromebooks. They don't really hold any that much information. So we're looking at that. We just haven't reached end of life yet for our first cycle of them. So we are looking at what that could look like.
So that's great. So we'll probably eliminate that 5%. So thank you very much for the report.
Sure. Anything else?
Just a couple of things. I think I love the idea of gathering information through parent-teacher conferences and at registration, because everyone's got to do that. I think that's great. And then are teachers trained on how to teach digital citizenship at all, like K-12?
Well, yes. Yes and no. We have a program in place already that we've had in place for many years. And it goes through E-rate, and that's how we get some of our federal money. So we have to show that we're teaching digital citizenship in all of K-12. But we've been using our library techs and the time that the students go into library for that. And I've been training the library techs and working with them on a consistent basis with that. And then we have it in ninth grade health, because all students have to take ninth grade health. But that's not enough. We know that. With all the tech that's been rolling out the last few years, Google has come out with many programs, and we are using Common Sense Media, which is where our curriculum comes from. And so there's a lot of resources on there that I'm utilizing to train teachers. We're offering PD on this at our Techie Boot Camp, at our August PD days. I'll be going to staff meetings and training teachers who are interested. So that's kind of the focus of our EdTech Leads next year, too, is to really roll this out and help teachers incorporate this more in the classroom.
Okay, thank you.
Mrs. Roger.
Yes. The information that you provided tonight, but I have a question. I'm not sure if it's a question for you.
Okay.
Who to direct it to. But in the digital citizenship realm, it appears from the data that we're not hitting that as frequently as we'd like to.
Yes.
And specifically with regard to cyberbullying, are you aware of how we are instructing students to respond to cyberbullying? Or would that be a question perhaps for Mrs. McGrath? Or
I can try to answer it.
Okay.
because it is the way the curriculum works, and I can just go from the curriculum, it spirals. So they will have cyberbullying lessons that are appropriate for young children, elementary level, and then build on that, and they'll get it again in middle school, high school. Okay, so we have that available. As far, it kind of goes hand in hand with what Ellen had asked about, the our teachers trained on how to do that. We're in the process of, so some are further along than others, but that's kind of where we're at. We want to start expanding those lessons and those activities and things to make sure we have more consistency across the district, and we all know we're all on the same page.
So at this point, would it be the library techs that are providing that instruction?
They are providing it, but what I found when I met with the ed tech leads and we looked at this data together, because they're all, you know, the tech leads at the sites, and they said, well, but I'm teaching it, and so we found that maybe we're relying on student responses to some of this, and perhaps some of the kids, you know, didn't remember when Mr. Curran did his whole unit at the beginning of the school year, and then his students are reporting that they're never taught. The other thing to think about is library techs didn't necessarily take or respond to this survey, and so we could be missing some of that too as well. But doesn't mean, you know, I still think we need to move forward and just use this data as a starting point, as kind of a launching pad for where we need to go next with digital citizenship.
Thank you. I would really be interested in learning about how, and this is not your bailiwick, mm-hmm. but how we are instructing students to respond to cyberbullying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is the approach that we're encouraging them mm-hmm. to take? And I don't know where that would come from.
I'd be happy to get that to you in Friday Focus, and we can include some of the curriculum that's specific to those areas.
That would be terrific. Mm-hmm. I would love it. Thanks.
Dr. Prater?
I'm so glad to see these actions, because I think you nailed it. I think, and Mrs. Roger, I know, is very insightful in her question, because we had, at the last Common Ground meeting, we had a random sample middle high school cyber panel of middle and high school students. I had no idea who we were going to get, and we had about 6 students come and speak to this group specifically around cyberbullying and digital citizenship, meaning those are the questions mm-hmm. the group had. Very much, Ms. Rogers, like you're just describing, you know, is the questions that were coming from parents from the committee were, you know, how are you learning these things and what does that look like? And what came out from the middle and high school students almost purely was they know that they were taught it. They just can't remember where. Mm-hmm. They know, they think they had it at one point, but they weren't sure. But they all agreed on one thing, that if it were more consistently implemented, if this was part of their everyday experience, because everybody's mm-hmm. reinforcing it in the classrooms, then it would be part of their daily experience. And I think I'm so glad it's up there, because mm-hmm. that is something yeah. that's coming out, mm-hmm. is some students remember and some students don't, but what we all know is we have to be reminded. And so it's a good and mm-hmm. worthwhile action mm-hmm. to take and embed.
So this is a discussion item, but I will go to the public. Is there anybody who'd like to talk? Mrs. Neuhauser? Mrs. Holmes, would you set the 3-minute timer, please?
My name is Judy Neuhauser. I'm Liz Essos. I'm really pleased to see that we're continuing to make progress on having access at home, or at least continuing to have the discussion about access at home. It seems in some ways that we've met a block that's difficult. I'm going to take a slight detour here, because one of the things I've noticed in this is there's a lot of data as to how often the teachers are using this in the classroom and are they using it daily or weekly and whatnot? And that kind of information for any teaching is really important. When I looked at the LCAP, I was really struck by parent requests. They weren't asking for more computer time for their children. What they were asking for was hands-on, outdoor, project-based learning. Those were the kinds of things that showed up in the parents. And I'd actually like to see the same kind of data analysis for what happens in the classrooms about science. Because the kinds of activities that happen with the robotics that you saw tonight don't just happen in a vacuum. I mean, Mr. Molar, you talked about how there were some of the vocabulary that you didn't know, and I guarantee those students didn't know it either until they started working hands-on. It wasn't information that they picked up from classes. It's information and vocabulary they pick up from the hands-on activities. And so I would really encourage this board and this district to continue to look at those hands-on activities and do the same kind of data analysis that you're doing for computers. I guarantee you kids are spending way more time on computers than they are doing hands-on activities. And I think as a school district, we really need to encourage that. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to address the board? Okay, seeing none, let's move on to item number 8.04, proposed revisions to Board Policy 5127, Students' Graduation Ceremonies and Activities. And I believe that would be Mrs. McGrath.
Thank you. Tonight, before you, you have a first reading of a board policy related to graduation ceremonies and activities. You will notice in the black ink shows the way the board policy currently reads. The red ink shows the gamut suggestion of an addition of addressing conduct at graduation ceremonies. You will also see in whatever shade of purple that is, the word unaltered added to ceremonial attire, which was a suggestion from our high school principals, and all of this information was reviewed by your board subcommittee on policy. So tonight is a first reading.
Okay. Mr. Quisenberry.
I'm glad you mentioned the unaltered ceremonial attire, such as a cap and gown at a ceremony. And I'm glad that you've got some input from the site principals, I'm assuming also assistant principals. The question I've had over the years is the sites have generally forbidden certain things, for example, lays or flower garlands or things like that. Did that come up in the discussion at all? Because I always thought that that was not necessarily a real alteration and kind of, in a way, sort of an enhancement. So
it's
an embellishment. Thank you, sir.
You bring up a great point. There's actually not an AR suggested by gamut related to this, but we did work together with the high school principals and assistant principals, you're correct, in creating a graduation contract that defines expectations for conduct even further, and that's also going to require parent and student signature of agreement. And within that contract, it does ask that students don't add additional embellishments to their caps, gowns, and graduation attire. I think the goal is to honor the class as a whole for meeting graduation requirements and also honoring the fact that this is a formal ceremony that is as much probably about the people in the audience celebrating their accomplishment as it is the students' accomplishment as well, and kind of honoring the fact that this is a formal ceremony that we want to show respect during that time.
Well, Mr. Millar.
I think it's excellent that the students and their parents and guardians are going to have the requirements, behavioral requirements. And I just want to commend staff from learning from incident last year. And I think this will go a long way toward putting students on notice and their parents on notice that we expect you to behave at school events. And if you don't, there are going to be consequences. So I think it's an excellent update to this board policy.
Thank you. It is important for seniors to understand that poor behavior as it gets closer to graduation has a lot of consequences because there's a lot of fantastic activities that they want to participate in.
Okay. Is there anybody from the public that would like to address us on this item? Okay. Now, this is a first reading. Shall we bring it back? Bring it back as an action consent agenda item next time, or would the board like to move this forward now?
You know, I think probably bringing it back for the action consent because we did have a lot of parental input around that previous incident. Who knows?
Right. So we'll bring this back, Mrs. McGrath, on the action consent agenda for the next meeting. Thank you very much. And I believe you're back on with item 8.05, proposed revisions to board policy 6170.1, instructional transitional kindergarten.
Yes, this is also a board policy related to transitional kindergarten, and you can see all the black ink shows the board policy as it stood previously. There is some blue ink there, which was input from Mrs. Shields and transitional kindergarten there, as well as a slight addition suggested, and it really just looks at defining the length of the day and the fact that we need to report that information, and not too drastic of a change. I don't believe on this policy there was a lot of revisions to just what it was referencing. You will see on the last page. This was also reviewed by your subcommittee.
Any comments from board members about this one? Mr. Quisenberry.
Just a comment and not really a question is my grandson was a beneficiary of the transitional kindergarten at Del Mar Elementary and as well as a number of other students, and I can just say from at least my limited sampling is that they've had a very successful kindergarten year, and I think a lot of it was due to this particular program.
Thank you. Mr. Millar.
I think the policy is fine. I'm a little bothered by the blue language regarding the length of the school day, and it has to comply with minimum and maximum lengths of the school day. And it's probably an attorney bias, but it's implicit in board policy that we will follow the law. So, and this is not the first time I've commented on this, where we have an affirmative statement that we will follow the law seems, frankly, redundant, but having said my piece, I'm content.
Okay. Well, thank you. Is there anybody from the public that would like to address us on this item? Seeing no one, so this is also a first reading. Shall we bring it back for action consent next time? Okay, we'll bring this back for action consent at our next meeting. Let's move on then to item, let me get to that spot. Item number 8.06, Measure D, San Luis High School Design Build Modification Number 2, Acme Construction, San Luis High School Infrastructure Guaranteed Minimal Profit or something, Guaranteed Maximum Profit. Maximum price. Thank you. Profit price. Yeah.
Is Joe still here? Mr. Miller? I purposefully did this to try this tonight. I wanted to try it.
Ryan, can you pull the microphone up?
Yeah. Is Joe around? Kim, do we know how this works? I purposely did this tonight because I wanted to try it. I wanted to try the lamp to see how it goes. There we go. There we are. All right. Perfect. So not super clear, but better. See? Good.
Nice job, Jesse.
Awesome. That's good. Perfect. Thank you. All right. So this item on the agenda is basically with our design build work at San Luis Obispo High School in particular. You know, half the project's leased back, the other half is design build. And so what we're doing is we're kind of kicking off that design build work by first getting some infrastructure in. So the picture that we have up here is basically this summer project that is going to begin the electrical, gas, water, sewer infrastructure work around the campus. So this area here is actually, or up top I should say, is the back of the 100 building. And that is where the new electrical service is going to go, which is over by the county, former county office of education classrooms, kind of our more severe special education classrooms in the back. And so along the back road, so within that road, is where the new gas, water, and electrical lines are going to go along the back, all the way down the side of the 100 building, down through to where the annex is. They'll connect to the old gym. The sewer line will then run all the way out to the sewer at San Luis Drive. And then along the road in between kind of the quad area and the new portables, it runs all the way to our new student support center. So so this particular infrastructure project, through a design build that I'm asking the board to approve tonight, is to through the back is electrical, gas, water. The electrical line actually goes along the edge. And then actually our annex project, as well as our student support building, has some of the other infrastructure work tied into those GMPs already. So the sewer on this line along the road is actually already built into those projects and is not part of this particular amendment that we're asking you to approve tonight. So that work is all going to kind of correspond, happen together. And so in the big picture of the budget, we had about $11 million towards infrastructure work at San Luis Obispo High School. And when they looked at the preliminary budgets and looked at our bridging documents, some good news that came out of this was, this tonight, and I'll have Kim, you can go ahead and pop up the actual amendment for me. The good news from this is that it looks like this amendment and what we're going to do, the work this summer, which is, I believe, about $2.5 million altogether. It's going to do a significant portion of the infrastructure. So, we're looking at hopefully some budget savings overall. They did find along the 300, 400 wing and through the auto shop, there was a lot of conduits that currently hold like cable TV and some electrical. And so instead of having to totally dig all that area up, put new conduits, put new lines through there, again, this is one of the benefits of design build, is that you're sitting with the architect, with the, the electrical consultants, and you're going through this process. So they feel, and in this case it's Tome Electric on this project, they feel that they can use those current conduits along the 300 all the way to the Student Support Center instead of having to redo that entire area. So significant savings for us to not have to do that. So I'm excited about that aspect of it, because this infrastructure work is probably one of the scariest things that both Mr. Holcomb and myself have been worried about from the get-go in terms of getting this established. And so this is necessary work to get done this summer so that we can actually, once that annex is built, turn it on and have classes in that building. It's going to be nice in terms of getting that infrastructure in while the kids are gone during the summer. We have shut that campus down. So besides Taylor Field and kind of the gym area there and the main Holt Field, pretty much the summer youth programs and things like that are going to happen at Laguna Middle School. So we've asked them to move those. So it's going to be a very scaled down, kind of happening at the site while this is all happening, along with, some big construction projects that are happening with Student Sports Center starting, as well as our annex, which is beginning to take shape. So those are kind of the key aspects of what this first, it's actually the second amendment to our design build. So we did a little bit of work with our design build last year, and that was the robotics room. as well as the new door for Tim Fay's classroom, and the new auto shop floor. So that was the very first amendment to our design build work. This would be the second amendment, which specifically is focused on that infrastructure work and getting it ready to go, again, for all of the projects that are happening at SLO High School.
Thanks. Yeah, Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. So, Ryan, the picture with the red lines and behind, hooking up behind. Thanks. So, I think it's great that we're moving that connection behind. Was it Building 100?
Mm-hmm.
But my and I see where our lines begin, but were the utilities there for us to hook into, or did the utilities have to be moved? Or
so there's a whole new, so because of all of the new new buildings and new electrical infrastructure that was needed, along with bringing air conditioning into this campus, there was a need for a whole new service to happen.
And so they're dropping lines.
The current location is kind of weird. It's behind the ag area, right across the street from the school farm. It's a little bit up top. And so, again, in working with Talma and working with the design and the consultants, we are going to move that whole area down behind the 100 building. There's actually an old custodial room that it's going to move into. And so we're going to redo the entire thing.
So let me try where this is. Mm-hmm. So are the utilities dropping new services for us to hook into? And so are we going to be using some of our old lines? So here's the utility coming in, there's old lines, and then it's going to move to the new location?
Answer that question, Mr. Holcomb? I mean, it's basically that we're pulling it from the outside still, right, from PG&E campus.
But directly from PG&E, or is it still running through some of our old stuff to get to the new location?
We're adding additional capacity through a new service.
Our
existing campus simply didn't have enough capacity because the big changes, our new buildings, all have air conditioning.
But the new service is coming directly from the utilities to the new transformers or whatever.
Right. It goes from there all the way up behind the 100 buildings. We're hitting it for 2 points, actually.
Okay, thanks. I want to make sure we weren't just new, going through old wires to get the new wires.
No.
Not at all.
This is all new. And adding extra conduit as we go. So for future potential expansion, any types of use in the future. So having that in the road, in place now, is, critical for the long term.
Right.
My question is, it might be kind of piggybacking on Mark's, I'm not sure, but where we're able to use the existing conduit and to bring new service through that conduit,
yes.
Are we going to pull the old cabling, or does it give us just additional capacity?
We're going to be replacing that cabling, but utilizing the conduit itself.
Okay, so everything.
So there's a lot of unnecessary. What they found was as they went through it, there was a lot of unnecessary current wires that are in there as well, like old cable TV wires that we don't use, old technology wires that we don't use anymore. So they feel like they have enough space within those four conduits that they found that they can pull out the old stuff and they can use they can run the new wires
through. Run the new service through.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Which is just a huge savings from the, again, having to dig it all up and, the earthwork and all of the, when you start digging in the ground, you hit transite pipe, you hit other things. And so it's a positive thing for us to be able to use those current conduits.
Ryan, if we're looking at $2.5 million here on this amendment.
Yes.
And did you say, what did you say?
We had about $10,500,000 budgeted. Again, as a projection budget
for
utilities and infrastructure at San Luis Obispo.
For infrastructure only. Okay.
Yes.
That's terrific. Thank you.
Yes.
Great. Anybody else from the board? Well, this is an action item, and so I'm going to go to the public. Is there anyone from the public who would like to address the board on this item? Okay, seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board. Would someone like to make a motion on this? Mrs. Roger.
Yeah, I'll move approval of item 8.06.
And seconded by Mr. Buckman. Any further board discussion? Seeing none, I'll bring it back for a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 7-0. Let's move on. Again, Mr. Pinkerton, item 8.07, amendment number, Measure D, amendment number 5 to lease-leaseback contract with Acme Construction for the San Luis Obispo High School old gym.
So the old gym, while infrastructure has been a savings, potential savings, and a remarkable one, hopefully, you know, I'm really hoping that we cut that infrastructure number in half by the time we're done, based on this information and kind of what we know to date and where we're headed. So that will be huge for us, you know, from a budget standpoint. The old gym has cost more than we initially had projected. I mean, as you, again, an old facility like that going into it, we've had three different amendments to the old gym to date. So we had a first phase, which was kind of a non-DSA phase. Then we had our DSA phase with the restrooms. It looks beautiful. If you have seen the old gym recently with the new windows coming in, it is a beautiful building. You know, it's going to be great. But the last aspect of the old gym is to do the ADA accessibility in the front. So, and that was always planned to coincide with the end of our temporary housing at San Luis Obispo High School. So we were waiting for the Bellevue Santa Fe project to happen so that we could get a couple of those you know, current portable classrooms there that they're going to be crunching getting rid of to utilize those as temp housing for a few years, which it's been a saving grace for San Luis Obispo High School for the ones that they have now even. I mean, with an increase in staff and with what happened with the 300 wing and the fire, having those extra classrooms on campus has been very, very useful for us. And so this kind of last phase of the temp housing is going to add two more portables next to the current portables that are behind the old gymnasium. With that, you get kind of a roundabout, which is a fire access, which is here. So this is the old gym. These are the current four portables. One goes next to it, one behind. The infrastructure for those, the electricity and everything else that's tied to those is already there in place. So that was something we did when we put those other four portables in. But now it's kind of just bringing those last two portables over. And so as part of the project, you get the fire turn. But we also redo the entire ADA accessibility to the front of the old gymnasium. So it's currently out of compliance. And so, again, those are two projects. So it's a temp housing, yet it's also finishing the old gym project. And so this last phase of temp housing is going on to our lease-leaseback project for the old gymnasium and tied to it. It seemed like the best kind of fit for us because we had done the temp housing with different contractors through through LLB in the past. So Vernon Edwards had done, John Madonna Construction had done one. And so it fit to have it tied into this project. So this amendment to this is $446,000 to finish the last two portable classrooms as well as complete the ADA accessibility work. Probably from a numbers figure, it's probably about $250,000 for the actual front of the old gym ADA work, and about $200,000 of that is actually the physically setting the portables from Bellevue Santa Fe up, bringing them over, setting them up, fixing the roofs, getting them all established so that they're going to last us for the next 5 years as we proceed through the 100 building and into the 400 building.
I don't see anybody from the board. Oh, I'm sorry.
Now, there is an allowance. I will tell you that they are having a difficult time finding a company to work with to actually do the physical setup of the portables. So a lot of the portable manufacturers are very busy right now. So they're actually, Acme Construction is working with Wison Construction, who's actually our Bellevue Santa Fe, to kind of see how they can work together. They have, I think, two or three potential companies that they're working with. So in lieu of having that set right now, they have put in they have put a, I just lost the word, an allowance to complete that work. But they feel it's one that it will meet the needs of the cost. So they've done this many times before, and they feel that it will be enough money for them to complete the job.
Okay, Marilyn.
Thank you. So I'm trying to understand here. We're putting those portables on pads?
So it's there currently already has, that's an asphalt area behind the old gym.
So we're not putting them on concrete pads.
No.
But why?
On asphalt.
Asphalt. Then I'm wondering why did it necessarily follow that we needed to do the ADA access? Was there an economy of scale by, because concrete was being poured out there anyway, to do the ramping now? Or, well, I'm not
so this aspect of the I can't remember the kind of the T shape there, that was all the fire department. So because of, for fire safety, you get a fire truck there, that we had to have that. So the hammerhead, they call it the hammerhead. So that's just an asphalt. This area here is just an asphalt hammerhead area for it.
Okay.
This then is concrete. So kind of, you know, fixing the whole ramp situation up to the old gym currently with the stairs. It all needed to be completely redone to make it ADA accessible. So that was, as PMSM was planning this project out, because we knew we were going to have to dig this whole area up anyways, as we, when we brought these in, it just made more sense to do the whole front of the old gym with this project. Again, what you'll see from my previous drawing as well is part of all of, you know, kind of getting all of this to happen. This is a sewer line that runs all the way to San Luis Drive that goes right in front of the old gym. So they'll be putting this in, then they'll be doing this project right afterwards. So it's kind of one of those phasing aspects. They couldn't do this before they put the sewer line in, and so it just kind of, you know, making it all kind of fit together in progression.
Do we anticipate that students will be using the old gym facility next year?
Not this summer. Next, in the fall?
Next,
absolutely,
in the fall.
Yes. This is a summer project. This will be completed by the fall.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Our hope was that they were going to be using it this summer, but we've talked to the site and said that you know, it's not going to work, basically. So we're keeping the newer gym open for them. They'll have to access it from the back side, but it'll be open.
Mr. Buckman, then Mr. Quisenberry.
Thanks. Ryan, I don't know if you have access to the notice of amendment guaranteed maximum price.
Uh-huh. Kim can pull it up.
Okay. I just noticed this. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's numbers don't work.
Yes.
Okay. So I just noticed that. And
so it's number five, right?
Actually, it's under temporary housing, I think. It says notice of amendment across the top. Yeah, that one. So if we go down, I just don't want to approve this with this in it if it's a mistake. So if we go down to the second paragraph, amendment number five, towards the end of that, it says the project is... Yeah, guaranteed maximum for the project is $9 million, and then the number in parentheses is $3 million, and so I know you probably can't see it.
Oh yeah, it should say $3 million instead of nine there.
So the first one's three. Well, Jim caught it too. We just
yeah,
but
it
yeah,
be a three.
I just, before we approve it, you'll make that change or?
Well, that would be a perfect thing for the, if somebody were to make a motion,
oh,
to
I'm
make
sorry.
Sure that was part of the motion would
Jim,
be great.
Okay. Okay.
And definitely, so, we'll change it before we sign off and send
okay,
it off.
Thanks. All right, so I'll make a motion that we approve 807 Measure D.
Before you do, I want to see if there's anybody from the public that would like to address us on this item. And seeing none, I'll bring it back to Mr. Buckman.
So I'd like to make a motion to approve Measure D Amendment Number 5 to the lease-leaseback contract for Acme Construction with the correction that Jim Cusimary and I are asking for.
And specifically that correction is in paragraph number 2 of the notice of amendment. The figure, the project figure as written out is $9,444,000, whereas the figure in the parentheses is $3,418,000. So the amendment is that those figures will match.
Absolutely.
Okay. Great. So we have a motion and a second. We have a motion by Mr. Buckman, a second by Mr. Quisenberry. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 7-0. Let's move on to the action consent agenda. Please let me know if you'd like to have anything pulled. Let's see, that would be item 9.01, approved certificated and classified personnel items. 9.02, approve revised program specialist job description. 9.03, approved revised secondary classroom teacher music job description. 9.04, approve revised elementary counselor job description. 9.05, approve revised secondary counselor job description. 9.06, approve new and modified secondary courses.
Can we hold off on 9.06, please? I'd like
sure.
to pull that.
9.06. And 9.07, acceptance of donations. 9.08, approval of foreign exchange organizations.
I'll move approval of items 9.01 through 9.05, 9.07, and 9.08.
We have a motion, and I'll second that. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, I'll bring it back. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 7-0. Let's move to 9.06. Mr. Quisenberry.
Yes. I think Kim said that some of these have been pulled as far as the music is concerned and then modified. I haven't looked at this until, I mean, I've looked at it, but I haven't looked at it just recently. So we, just to make this clear, we're no longer requiring private lessons for the advanced courses, and I think that was in the wind ensemble.
That wording was found in two different courses, in honors jazz band and wind ensemble, I think.
Right.
Chris found as well. So right, the wording was changed from needing to take private lessons to expecting to practice extensively or something along those lines.
So unfortunately what's in here still says the students will also be expected to take private lessons on their instrument either with a local private instructor or in a group lesson setting after school.
Which course are you on?
So I'm under wind ensemble, I think.
I think that's where I saw it.
So I think it still says...
I think that was caught and changed.
I believe I talked to you this morning about that.
No, mine now currently says students should expect to practice extensively outside of class.
Okay, so somewhere...
It's
been caught since
exactly.
then. Okay, thanks.
So... I'll move approval of, what is it, 9.07, is that correct?
9.06.
9.06.
Okay.
I'll second.
We have a motion by Mr. Quisenberry, a second by Mrs. Sheffer. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 7-0. Let's move on to advanced agenda. And so at this point... Mr. Pinkerton had a request that we have a discussion or that he be able to bring back to the board information about a possible mutual aid agreement with Lucemar School District and possibly other school districts. Does the board have an interest in that?
Can't staff bring things to us without the board?
Well, Mr. Millar, is because he asked for a consensus from the board at that point, and I didn't feel that would be appropriate for us to have a consensus at that point. I thought it was more appropriate to do it during advanced agenda. So that's why I hung it there. Okay. Mr. Buckman?
So I was just going to suggest we'd have the normal process for doing advanced agenda. I'd like to just recommend that we just do this now.
Which is?
Just give our thumbs up to it.
Yeah. So is there a consensus for Mr. Pinkerton to bring this back to the board? Okay. So you have your consensus. Okay.
Can you just have him bring it back as an action item?
Yeah. Yeah, when you get it. Okay. Good. Let's go on to reports by board members. Anybody? Mrs. Sheffer, we'll start there.
The celebration at Bellevue Santa Fe was wonderful with the students and a little tour of the school. I really appreciated it. I hadn't been there while class was in session for a while. And I also wanted to thank Mr. Holcomb for taking the time over spring break to schlep me around, and Mrs. Roger also, to look at work that's being done on the schools, it's on the sites. It's kind of nicer, calmer to be there, less I feel less disruptive to be there when the students aren't there to look around, and his knowledge and information is always welcome. So thank you very much for that.
Okay, Mr. Buckman.
Thank you very much. So I was able to attend the parent leader meeting last month, and I wanted to just give a shout out to Erin Primer. She did an absolutely phenomenal presentation on health and the relationship to eating, and maybe a little above and beyond. So that was great. I'd also like to give a shout out to Dr. Prater for his I would say impassioned comments on equity and the future that's going to hold in our district. So I'd like to thank you for that. I also would like to mention, I think, Kim, there were about 15 folks there, PTAs, boosters, and I think that's just a great turnout. And I'm just wondering if we could reach out to the Aggie backers.
They're invited.
They are invited. Thank you. Okay. So anyway, so it was a great meeting. I also attended a board member class at the county office on update on sexual harassment policies, and that was also excellent as well.
Great, and I'll just finish up. After going over to Bellevue, Santa Fe, I stopped by Pacific Beach, and as always, it was great. One of the things that was really nice is they're exploring dual enrollment classes there. And so when I was in Mrs. Noreen's class, she was explaining that to me. As part of my NSBA commitment, I attended their annual education conference. And I just wanted to point out two speakers I heard that were pretty amazing. One was a Dr. Christopher Emden, who's a math instructor, a math professor at Columbia. And he reminded us to treat all students individually and to value their experiences. And this particularly talking about African-American students. And then we heard from Ernest Green, who was one of the original Little Rock Nine. It's the second Little Rock Nine individual that I've heard. And he talked about his experiences. He talked about how Thurgood Marshall stayed in his home. He talked about how Dr. Martin Luther King attended his graduation ceremony. And I just think it's important for us to remember that the civil rights struggle continues. And then finally, I want to just acknowledge a Morro Bay High School graduate named Jordan Cohen. Jordan is living in Austin, Texas right now. We visited him. He was a music student from Mr. Bellier's back with my son in 2006, 2007. Jordan is now, he has established an orchestra program at a charter school in Austin, Texas, and it's just amazing to see one of our high school graduates moving on and really helping the community there and just doing a great job. So kudos to Jordan Cohen. And with that, we will call this meeting adjourned. Thank you very much. We'll see everybody May 1st.